This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining our virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. You know, music, everybody has a different kind of music that they love, and sometimes they learn to love something because they hear it for the first time. And today we're going to talk about an instrument that's somewhat unusual in my musical background, but this is a great opportunity to learn a lot about it because we have perhaps the world's best-known harpist in the studio here at Prairie Public, Yolanda Condonasis. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
And joining us as well is Christopher Zimmerman, the music director of the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra. Thank you. We're talking about an upcoming concert at the NDSU Festival Concert Hall. It's this Saturday and Sunday. It is the Sanford Health Masterworks Series Concert Number 2, and it features Yolanda on the harp. Let's talk about the concert itself first. The upcoming concert and the Masterworks idea, Christopher, give our listeners a sense of what that's about.
So we have three pieces we're performing this weekend. All are very different from each other, which is something I like to do to give the audience a kind of wide palette, as it were. First piece also actually features Yolanda, but also with one of our principal players, our principal flute player. They are playing the one movement of a Mozart concerto for harp and flute. And then Yolanda will be playing, as we will talk about in a minute, this brand new piece by an American composer, Jennifer Higdon. And in the second half of the program, we're playing a big symphonic work by Carl Nielsen, who is a Danish composer. It's a very, very dramatic, vivid, and kind of slightly off-kilter piece, which I think the audience will be intrigued by.
All right. Well, Yolanda, give us a little bit of your biography here. Where did you come from? How did you get to learn to play the harp and all that?
Well, you know, I've been doing this a while, and I started when I was about 9. And being back in this part of the country always feels really comfortable for me because I grew up in Norman, Oklahoma, which is sort of incongruous. The next question after I tell people where I'm from is, how in the world might you get into playing the classical harp in Norman, Oklahoma? And that's actually a very good question. I ask myself that sometimes. But my mother was a musician. My father is first generation Greek, and we moved to Norman before I was born so that my father could teach economics at the University of Oklahoma. So we were kind of a transplant family, and even though I can lapse into my Oklahoma accent at will, but I won't. I think my mom started me on the harp to try and refine me a bit because I was developing into a bit of a tomboy. And something I've said often is that, you know, instead of me becoming a little bit more angelic with the harp, I think perhaps through the arc of my career, the harp has perhaps become a little less angelic with me. And, you know, commissioning new works is a big part of that that arc of my career and trying to bust the harp out of its cliche box and do some new and unique and more powerful things with it.
Well, how did the classical harp come to be? It looks like a string soundboard that's been pulled out of a piano to me.
Well, you know, every culture since the beginning of time really has had some version of the harp, the idea of plucked strings on a frame, of course, from the very primitive to now what we have, which is a very sophisticated machine. And a lot of people don't know it's quite as much of a machine as it is. You know, they see the beautiful giant triangle and, you know, usually they're beautiful carvings, beautiful, you know, aesthetic treatment of the instrument. But inside the harp is, you know, it's not a 21st century machine. It's more of an early 19th century machine, but it kind of looks like a typewriter inside. There are levers and lines of linkage and pedals that we use to create what would be the black keys on the piano. The plain strings of the harp, untouched, are, you know, easiest way to describe it might be like the white keys of the piano. And, you know, if you play complex repertoire, you really need those black keys. So you have to do all that with your feet. So audiences this weekend should pay close attention to not only what my hands are doing, but my feet will be doing their part as well, because it's essential to playing anything of interest.
Is it hard to keep it tuned?
Well, yeah, you tune a lot. I would say on a given day of active playing, rehearsal, and performance, I'll tune a harp anywhere from 3 to 4 times, and then touch up in between. But, you know, there's also the matter of string breakage, which has become a real problem in the recent couple of years because I won't go into great depth, but because of new mad cow regulations in the United Kingdom, the quality cow gut that used to make the best, toughest, most resilient strings is now unavailable. They have to destroy cows at a certain age to, I guess, stave off the mad cow disease. So our string breakage has just become crazy. So we'll all, as a community, keep our fingers crossed that we will not have any strings breaking this weekend.
Well, I didn't know about the innered workings of the harp. Let's get a sample of Yolanda Condenas's playing the harp. This is a piece from J.S. Bach. It's part of a prelude. Let's hear what it sounds like. Well, that's just a sample of a little bit of Bach, Yolanda Condenas. That sounds very delicate. How long does it take to learn to do that?
Well, you know, I've been doing it over 40 years. And, you know, in that time I just recorded the Higdon Concerto, and I think that made my 23rd recording. So I've been doing it a while, and it gets easier as you go along a little bit. But.
Well, Christopher, you're the music director of this particular symphony, and you've been collaborating with other symphonies to basically be able to premiere a work. We're talking about the Jennifer Higdon piece that Yolanda will play on Saturday and Sunday. How does that work?
I'd just like to chime in. I'll answer that, but something, you know, you said it sounded very delicate. One of the things about Yolanda, which is so attractive to me, when we first worked together, we worked on a modern piece too by Gina Serra. And I was under the conception that harp playing was, you know, angelic. But immediately I heard her play the sound, the size of the sound, the quality of the music making, the diversity of the sound was so attractive to me because she really tears this instrument up in the best possible way.
All right.
And the reason I say that now is because, so this piece that we're doing was actually recommended by Yolanda to me. She said, would you be interested in being part of a premiere of this brand new piece? And I thought, well, if it's Yolanda asking me and it's a brand new piece, you know, she's going to play the bejesus out of it. It's going to be something really meaty, and I was excited by that. So, yes, so I said, well, look, I'll look into this. I have to talk to obviously, the Fargo Moorhead Symphony Orchestra to see whether this
there's
is a viable
investment
option.
Involved, yeah.
And what happens in, we call it a consortium, which is basically the piece is commissioned. I think Yolanda personally commissioned it from, I'm not quite sure I've got this right, but from the composer. It costs a certain amount of money for the composer to write the thing. And then a number of orchestras buy into that. And we're one of, I'm not sure how many, six or
six.
Seven?
Six.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know which also which performance we are at this point.
I think this is there are 7 performances actually because I repeated it
with the
Rochester Phil so that we could do a live recording. So this is actually the 5th.
The 5th. So we are part of that whole premiere process, which is very exciting. I like to tell audiences, at the risk of being somewhat repetitive, you know, how important it is obviously to premiere new pieces, as you wouldn't have any of this repertoire at all. Beethoven had to be played first time.
Well, the piece is titled very simply Harp Concerto, and does it test your virtuosity?
Oh, sure. And I think it's so important on a more unusual instrument like the harp to find that sweet spot, that balance of pushing the instrument forward, of pushing what listeners expect to hear on the instrument, pushing the technique, pushing the idiom, but at the same time being idiomatic. That's the trick. And I was fortunate enough to be able to work with Jennifer along the way with this. She's a consummate composer, Pulitzer Prize winning, multiple Grammy winning composer, and so she knows what she's doing. But I think I have yet to meet a composer who doesn't express at least a little bit of trepidation before writing for the harp, and that's why the harpist has to be so involved.
So how do you collaborate with a composer? Do you say, I want to do a riff here or something like that? How do you do
this? Oh, no. She writes the piece. Uh-huh. I wasn't in her her business in terms of doing that part of it. But, before she ever started writing, we spent a day together in Philadelphia where she lives. And I just played the harp all afternoon for her. I just played everything I knew, told her what works, told her what was typically awkward, what to stay away from. And, concurrent with this whole project, I have a book that's going to be out in the spring called A Composer's Guide to Writing Well for the Harp. And, as you might imagine, it expanded from a little guide to about 200 pages worth of everything I know to do and not to do about doing that. So, every project helps inform, I think, how to synthesize the best of this instrument without taking it to the point where it just can't be done.
Well, you've got a website, YolandaHarp.com. That's Yolanda with a Y. And I went up there and I was picking around there, here and there. And it's full of information, including lots of Q&As about very interesting projects that you've been involved with. Christopher, I'm curious with you, though, when you're directing, conducting the symphony, and you've got a featured performer on stage, what is the role of the rest of the folks up there?
Well, it's like any other concerto, really. I mean, it's a modern concerto, but, I like to think I'm a sensitive accompanist in the sense that...
Which you are.
I'm happy, sometimes the conductor and the soloist have a difference of how things should go, and it can be a little bit ugly.
Have you worked together before?
We have, okay. Quite a few times. But my feeling is that when it comes to a concerto, basically, Yolanda is the featured artist, as you put it, and I'm not about to get in the way, especially as, she knows this piece backwards and forwards. So our job is to accompany her as best we can, which means try and be two things, I guess, that we play the right notes at the right time. That always helps. But also that we balance it so that she doesn't get covered, because it's actually a big orchestra and the piece is pretty complicated. Lots of things going on at the same time. In fact, we were talking about this just yesterday because the harp is obviously doesn't project like a trumpet, and whether we would have some sound support or not.
Well, what was the decision?
Yes.
Okay. How much time will you have to rehearse with Christopher and the orchestra?
We'll have two rehearsals tonight and tomorrow, and with somebody like Christopher, that will be plenty of time to make it cohesive.
And that says a lot about musicians too, because obviously they have to be competent enough to do it in two rehearsals.
Well, it's true. We have two with Yolanda, but we've had two rehearsals already. We've gone through the piece a couple of times and rehearsed it a bit.
It's tricky.
It's tricky, And it's brand new, so no one knows how it goes.
Christopher, how would you describe a concert by the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony Orchestra to a first-time ticket buyer?
I would imagine that people will not expect it to be as good as it is, for whatever that may mean, because I think people don't expect classical music here to be at the level that
it's always better to exceed expectations.
I think they will be pleasantly surprised. I certainly love my job here. I think the orchestra plays well. I also think they will be impressed by the level of sound, the size of the sound, especially in the string part of the orchestra. And I think they will also be impressed by what I think is very special. The orchestra. Some orchestras kind of sit there and go through the motions. My feeling, I hope I'm not wrong about this, is this orchestra actually actively really gets involved, and you can feel a palpable sense of enjoying the actual music making itself. It's not just phoning it in.
Yolanda, is your life
to be an itinerant harpist? Is that what you do? You go all around the country, the world? And
a gypsy?
Yeah.
Well, pretty much. That is what I do. I also am a professor at Oberlin Conservatory and the Cleveland Institute of Music. And I did a great deal of orchestral playing very early in my career, but I soon realized that really what I love to do is to be a soloist, and that's what I've made my life at.
What's it like to travel with an instrument that is pretty big and rather delicate?
Well, every date, every engagement is a little bit different. For this one, I flew into Minneapolis and rented a minivan and rented a harp from one of my favorite former students.
Oh, so it's not your personal harp then?
Not this one. And then on a very snowy, icy night before last, I drove from Minneapolis over to Fargo, which, you know, I don't mind. I love to drive. I love that open road feeling. I liked it better before cell phones. But
well, they get icy highways in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
The harp, as I mentioned, big, imposing instrument. What's its value typically? I mean, these are kind of all custom made, aren't they?
Well, you know, it's all relative, because if I played the violin, I might have a loan for $1.5 million or more for a Stradivarius violin. But a great harp, I own two at the moment, and each one of them cost about $40,000. So, it could be much worse, but the downside of the harp is they do not appreciate, because they're machines, and the tension of the strings, there's a couple tons of pressure on the wood and the soundboard and the frame. So over time, it starts to bend, to twist, to give way, and, you know, mechanical parts just wear out.
And as our producer, Skip, just reminded me that it won't fit in the overhead bin.
Oh, heavens, no. No. So I have a minivan myself, and when it's close, I'll drive my own harp.
Let's listen to another sample of Yolanda Koundinasis on the harp, and this is from her album, Solo Harp, the best of Yolanda Koundinasis. Of course, the best may be yet to come, but this is a rhapsody composed by Marcel Grangeny, and we'll get a little sample of that. That's one person playing the harp, right? How do you do that?
Well, I have an assistant behind me with a couple of additional pairs of hands.
Huh?
Yeah. I playing the harp is a really important mixture of technique and musicianship, but, you know, you cannot downplay the necessity of really sound good technique, because it's kind of an unnatural instrument to play. It's not, you don't have gravity going for you. You really have to have a sound way of approaching the instrument and protecting yourself from injury and whatnot. So I guess as both a performer and a teacher, I really, you know, believe in sort of addressing the chops issue.
Christopher, this is again part of the Masterwork series, and this is concert number 2. Yeah. How is the series? What's next, and how do you decide on all that stuff?
So we have 5 concerts in the year, 5 master series, as you call them. And what I do is I sit down with Linda Boyd, the executive director of the orchestra, for a whole afternoon. And I've come up with some ideas, and usually Linda's come up with some ideas. And you'd think that might be a battle, but it isn't usually a battle. We kind of we are pretty simpatico, actually. I'm very happy to say, because that's not always easy with an executive director. And like most conductors, I think the programming is kind of my territory, right? But Linda's brilliant. She manages to make suggestions in a way. For instance, I'll give you an example. One of my favorite composers is Shostakovich, the Russian composer, because his music is very passionate, very visceral. You know, it's great stuff. But it's a little dark. And I wanted to do one of his symphonies in January up here. So Linda explained that that's not on, you know, and I got it. You know.
Let's have a little springtime sound here. Right. Huh? Okay, well, it's the Masterwork Series Concert No. 2 by the FM Symphony Orchestra. It's this Saturday and Sunday at NDSU's Festival Concert Hall. That is 7:30 in the evening on Saturday, 2 in the afternoon on Sunday. Tickets are $30 to $38 with the range of $12 to $15 for students. And you'll hear something you might not have ever heard before. Yolanda Condonassis, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher Zimmerman, music director, thank you for
thank
being
you
with us.
Too.
Coming up, a commentary from Jamestown's Bruce Berg.
Thanks to the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting our arts programming. They are now offering their special edition ornaments. This year, spearfishing decoys, small, hand-carved, individually painted fish made by North Dakota master craftsman Rick Whittier. See them at nd.gov/arts or the North Dakota Heritage Center gift shop.
Thank you for listening to Main Street. I'm Doug Hamilton. Bruce Berg likes to write and to read and to share his commentaries with us on Main Street. And today our retired English teacher from Jamestown offers his thoughts on great writers in an age of not-so-great readers.
My wife is reading Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, a novel that, well, over 200 writers deem the best novel in the past few centuries. High praise. She finds the reading heavy at times, but not quite the weight of War and Peace, which can build big muscles if lifted on a regular basis. My wife is a reader, and she sought to add the genius of Tolstoy to her reading knowledge, despite those who say, oh, it's a boring work and it takes time to read. After a slow start, which is par for the classic of the past, she finds the book detailed beyond most of what she has read. And she finds that much of the book is dedicated to characters' thoughts. Tolstoy takes his readers into heads. The great Russian writer, fluent in 15 languages, took time to write, and I suspect he does not assume that he's being thoughtless because it will take his readers time to read. Maybe it's our busy day and age. Maybe we've been exposed to a rush-rush world that has forgotten the knack of patience. Maybe the flip, flip, flip of the TV world is carried over to our reading. Whatever, as a people, we don't or won't or can't seem to slow the pace of reading entertainment. We're programmed for speed and we have trouble getting off the track. Some say we get bored easily and have developed a capacity to get bored without giving much time for the concept that, well, maybe boring people get bored easily. Anyway, great novels take us outside ourselves. They don't just repeat what we already know. Great novels make us think because they are written by thinking people. Great novels make us stretch. They take us on long trips to different places on the planet and different places in our own mental attics. We remember the surprises we found in our home attics. Well, those same surprises belong to those who will go upstairs and turn on the lights of a novel and discover that thing or idea that makes reading so worthwhile in the effort of the quest. This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
Coming up on Main Street, a Harvest Public Media report about finding replacements for retiring farmers. Then Root Cellar Sue will join Ashley Thornburg and me to talk about fall vegetable soups, and we'll go on to share our What's Happening calendar of things to do. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A big power outage affected thousands of customers south and east of Bismarck. It affected both MDU and Capital Electric Cooperative, and it happened around 6 a.m. Power was out for a time to the cities of Lincoln and McKenzie. Wes Engbrecht is with Capital Electric.
There was an issue with the transmission line somewhere that was southeast of here. You know, we don't know. There were reports that somebody saw an arc, which means the line must have dropped. onto another line possibly for some reason and caused an outage. And once the transmission line goes down, it affects a lot. You know, that's what feeds the substations, and the substations feed everything else. So when you have that happen, it's a major outage.
MDU says an owl caused the arcing in a substation. The outage affected two elementary schools and the University of Mary. Power was restored by late morning. Grand Forks State Senator Ray Holmberg was reelected this week, and the Republican is reaching a milestone.
This was my 12th election, so I have already completed 42 years. Serving out this next election, then I would tie with two others for the longest serving in state history.
Those other lawmakers are David Nething of Jamestown and Dwayne Much from Larimore. To what does he attribute winning re-election so many times?
You have to keep in contact. You have to read how society and how the district is changing, because at the end of the day, your job is to represent their wishes and aspirations and not a party line, for example, or a particular dogma. If you do that, which I think I have been doing, you can win election even when the winds are blowing against your party.
Holmberg chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee. And on Tuesday, the city of Fargo voted to establish an approval voting system. This means voters in city elections will now be able to vote for every candidate they want to. The winners are the most approved candidates. Cass County Auditor Mike Montplaisir will be overseeing these elections. He says in the event of a tie, election results would be recounted as usual, but if a winner could not be determined, the race could then be decided the old-fashioned way.
It used to be you'd flip a coin, but I brought up to the legislature, well, in some of these small communities, I may have a seven-way tie for a park board because everybody wrote in their neighbor because nobody wanted it. So I think we got down to drawing straws.
Fargo is the first city in the nation to establish an approval voting system. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. War is a tragedy and an exercise in brutality, but it still has rules. What are they? And who do we hold accountable when they are broken? On the next episode of Why, we'll take a philosophical look at war crimes and ask how we punish and prevent them. So join me and my guests, Jessica Wolfendale and Matthew Talbert, for What Are War Crimes? On the next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. As the farming population ages, who will take the reins? Last week, we heard about the challenges of farmland transfers. Today, we hear from Iowa's poet laureate, Mary Schwander, who helps guide farmers through these tricky transitions. Harvest Public Media's Kate Young sat in on one of Schwander's legacy letter workshops in Bloomington, Indiana, and has this report.
My great-great-grandfather farmed 2,000 acres. He was a huge cattle guy. The railroad spur came up into our property, and he would send cattle to Chicago on that.
That's Mary Schwander, reading from a book called The Future of Family Farms. She's reading a letter written by a farmer about the history of his land.
The track was taken out in the late 1970s, but in dry years, you can still see it. Those 2,000 acres were then divided among their three children.
Schwander is the poet laureate of Iowa. She's also a playwright and the artistic director of Schwander Woman Productions, which takes agricultural plays throughout the United States. This day, she's here for a performance of Map of My Kingdom.
That's a play about farmland transition. We've been touring this play now for 3 years. It was originally commissioned by Practical Farmers of Iowa to help families open up a conversation about how they were going to donate the land or whatever their plans might be for their farms and to help them talk about it, because we didn't, you know, traditionally, we were good Midwesterners, we didn't talk about anything like this that had money and death attached to it, especially.
Iowa and other farm states are facing a major transition. More than half of Iowa's farmland is owned by people over the age of 65. That means a lot of land is changing hands in the near future, and a lot of tough decisions. When farmers who own their land pass it along, they often want to divide it equally between their heirs. But those who want to farm may not be able to buy out their other relatives.
If you don't make a plan, oftentimes the farm will be just sucked up into urban sprawl or, you know, a large corporate farm.
That's why Swander and the Practical Farmers of Iowa recommend that farmers put their goals for their land into their own words.
Just write something down on the paper that your family can then talk about, reflect upon, discuss before you go into that expensive meeting with your lawyer.
After the play, workshop participants pair up to begin interviewing each other about their farms with a set of questions that Swander provides.
Okay, so why don't I start interviewing you, Bob?
Okay, all right.
So tell me where your farm is located and how many acres there are.
Okay, this is a northern part of Monroe County and 200 acres.
To give some guidance, Swander shares examples from the book where the guy's writing about his great-grandfather, the cattle guy.
The key to making a really evocative letter that somebody's going to read is these details. He talks about the train track and how it was taken out, but you can still see it on a dry day. Isn't that nice? It's just a beautiful image, you know. There's real poetry to this guy.
Swander stresses it's also important to convey what really matters to you for the future of your farm. If your heirs understand that you want to see the land continue as farmland, they might take the time to find a buyer who wants to grow food. Or they might choose to keep the land and lease it out to a young farmer who doesn't own land but wants to grow food. These non-traditional land transfers take time to set up, which is why Swander wants to help farmers start the conversation as early as possible. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Kate Young.
Kate Young runs Earth Eats, which is based at WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. That's part of the Harvest Public Media Reporting Collaborative. Next on Main Street, root seller Sue Balcom.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Poplar's Music in Grand Forks, serving educational, church, and family music needs since 1909. And now offering the full line of Yamaha pianos and keyboards, in addition to many other instruments and music supplies. More info at poplarsmusic.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and we're going to Bismarck to talk with Sue Balcom because it's time for another episode of Main Street Eats with root seller Sue.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Nothing I like better than talking about food.
And this is a season, some people call it fall, some people call it sweater season, some people call it soup season.
Some people call it, I'm going to Arizona in a couple weeks,
true.
We'll see you in the spring. However, I'm a hearty North Dakotan. I like winter. I like winter because it's soup season. If you've noticed with the weather kind of getting a little bit colder that your body is craving carbs and nice hot stews and soups, and this is a season for using up those fall harvested vegetables also, you know, like carrots, potatoes, pumpkin, squash, onions. We actually had our last farmer's market yesterday, but we still have a few of those vegetables left. And so now we're thinking, time to start making soup.
Well, let's make some soup. Do you just start with a broth or a stock?
Actually, one of my husband has actually said to me that if someone had told him he was eating squash soup, you know, and liking it 10 years ago, he would not have believed him. And it's a very simple to use things like carrots, potatoes, and squash to make a nice creamy soup to enjoy. So if you come home from work and you want to peel and chop some potatoes, or let's take them one at a time. If you use potatoes, you want to dice the potatoes up, saute them in some butter. If you like butter, make sure it's lots of butter and some onion. And then if you have a particular seasoning that you like, whether it's oregano or just salt and pepper, you cook until tender, and then you add a quart or two, depending upon how many people you have, of chicken stock. And then because it's creamy potato soup, you want to just add a little milk in there, and serve it with sour cream or crumpled bacon bits. It's so simple, and it's just a fun way to enjoy an excess harvest of potatoes. Now, if you're using squash and or carrots, which are lovely orange soup base, you'll want to do the same thing where you peel and chunk them up and saute them with onions. I would add celery this time. Also apples, especially if you're making a carrot soup. You want to introduce 3 or 4 nice tart apples, preferably from your own tree, and soften those vegetables up and then put the chicken stock in there again, like I said, 1 or 2 quarts, and let that simmer. And then with a squash or carrot soup, you'll want to puree that. So if you don't own a stick blender, that is one of the gadgets that I have lived most of my life without, that I'm wondering why.
Yeah, I've got one, and they're not that expensive, and they work great.
Oh, my gosh, they're such a blessing, because otherwise you have to kind of cool your soup off and put it in a blender. But this way, you just take a stick blender and you can blend it while it's on the range. Just don't stick your finger in it like I did when I was demonstrating to my granddaughter how not to use a stick blender. And now I have like a wonky fingernail.
I want to see your YouTube demonstration on that one.
Oh, God, it was scary, you guys. I'm like, what was I thinking? I'm holding the button and I've got my finger underneath it. And I'm like, now don't do this. Boom. It was bad. And it was tomatoes I was blending. So she's horrified, looking at the floor, thinking that's my blood spilled on. So be careful with that stick blender. But if you don't have one, they are amazing. So then you blend that soup till it's nice and smooth, and then serve it. You know, you can do that fancy thing that they do with cappuccinos with sour cream on top of a squash soup. You can season squash soup either sweet or savory. I'm a savory person. My husband's just got a big sweet tooth. So with that, we would use cinnamon, nutmeg, some ginger. And if you've got fresh ginger root, you can simmer that in there too. But I would remove that because it's a little harder and stringier than using a powdered ginger in there. Or if you want, you can just use straight up salt and pepper. And that's my favorite way to eat it. And it's just delightful. And, you know, squash and carrots, orange vegetables have lots and lots of carotenes in them, which are really, really good for you. So it's a healthy soup. It's a good way to use up some of those extra vegetables from your garden.
Well, besides, a fall veggie soup, which is, of course, appropriate to the season, we also have this time of year, people make chili. And certainly people where you're from make Nephila soup.
Yes, we do. And I make the world's best Nephila soup. But you might hear that from other people, too, that they make it. But they might tell you that I make it the best, too. But my Nephila soup is got a clear chicken stock with celery and onions in it. And it's kind of like eating a broth bowl. You know, like I make my Nephila fried up with potatoes and sauerkraut. And then we offer them bowls of Nephila. And then I have chicken stock cooked with vegetables like carrots and celery and onions, and flavored with a bay leaf and some allspice. And then you pour that, take as much solid as you want and pour as much broth on it as you want. And then if you want it creamy, you got to add your own cream, because I like clear soups, especially Nephila. It's not quite so heavy. And that sauerkraut adds a lot of good flavor to that. But, oh, man. Oh, I just hate thinking about Nephila soup because I just haven't had any in so long.
What would be the substantial difference, or maybe there's not a substantial difference, when you're making soups if you use a broth or a stock?
There is no difference in my mind between a broth and a stock. And I have to laugh because my freezer has special baggies in it. So when I trim off my celery leaves, I save all that. Mm-hmm. I save any kind of dead garlic or extra onion, broccoli stems, whatever we don't eat vegetable-wise, and all the bones from the chickens, from the roasts, in the freezer. And then once every couple months I have soup stock day or soup broth day, whatever you want to call it. But nowadays, of course, it's very popular to say bone broth. And I'm just scratching my head like, what do you mean? Bone broth, you mean like soup stock, right? You just take this stuff and roast it. I always roast my bones in the oven, and then I put them into my pressure cooker, which I love my pressure cooker, and add water and onion and garlic and whatever vegetable scraps I have, whatever I have in the freezer from meat scraps that we didn't, you know, touch or eat and don't want to have for leftovers. And 20, 30 minutes later, you have a substantial, healthy bone broth for your soups. You can pressure can it, or you can keep it in your freezer. And do not take the fat off of it at this point. That's key. Your broths will stay much fresher if you let that layer of fat sit on the top of them. However, the advantage to making your soup stock in advance is that you will also be able to take all that fat off of there. So you'll have all the nutrients, all the good stuff from the bones that you cooked, and all the fat will be gone. You'll have a less greasy soup and a healthier soup.
And you can adjust the salt level in it too, which some people need to watch that.
Absolutely. You don't even have to add salt. You can add other kinds of spices, you know, pepper. And like I mentioned earlier, allspice and bay leaf are two good seasonings to put in. My mom, notoriously, when she made soup, and we had soup every Sunday, it was either vegetable or chicken noodle, and she always served it in the same yellow, big yellow bowl that she set on the table. And we all took turns, you know, having our bowl of soup, and my dad ate all the leftover meat that had been, you know, simmered, so there couldn't have been any flavor left in it because it was all in the soup, but he ate it anyway. But she always put in three balls of allspice and one bay leaf every time she made any kind of soup. So I always do that just because she did it. So there you have it.
Bon appetit. We've checked in with Root Cellar Sue. We do this every week here on Main Street. Thanks for being with us, Sue.
Thank you.
What's happening is next.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. The 2018-2019 season, Time Travel, continues with The Most Wonderful Time of the Year, 7:30 p.m., November 16th and 17th at the Bell Mahus Auditorium, featuring holiday classics and the Bel Canto Children's Choir performing The Snowman. Tickets are available online at bismarckmandansymphony.org.
Well, that's the question. What is going on? It's getting cold out there. It's November. Thanksgiving is looming, but there's still time, you know, to do some stuff outside and as we move inside.
Well, how about this one? How about do something inside that reminds you of being outside?
I like that.
Choose your own space adventure this Saturday the 10th in Moorhead at the planetarium on the campus of Minnesota State University, Moorhead. Do you remember those choose your own adventure kind of chapter books where it was like a skip ahead if you choose this and then you'd read a different chapter?
Look at how old I am. No, I don't.
No. Okay, well, you can do this at the planetarium. You become a co-pilot on a space adventure and you choose your own destination where in space that you want to go. And this is, again, Saturday, November 10th in Moorhead at the MSUM Planetarium. Gets going at 10 a.m. and the cost is $3 to $13.
And we're reminded that this Sunday is Veterans Day, first known as Armistice Day, and a Sunday in Bismarck at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum, there'll be a presentation titled The Great War and the Middle East. It'll be presented by Joseph Stewart. He's an associate professor of history at the University of Mary, and it'll continue his conversation on the perspectives on the legacy of World War I, relating some of his recent thinking and research on the lasting effects the Great War has had on the Middle East. A lot of boundary lines for those countries were drawn after that war. It's 2 o'clock on Sunday at the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. It is free.
There are some escape room activities in Sydney, Montana this weekend at the former Sunrise Equipment Building. And this is the Boys and Girls Club of Richland County is hosting its second annual escape room. And there's going to be two different themes here. You can choose between Harry Potter and Zombie Land. And if you don't know this concept of these escape rooms, you go in and then you have to figure out how to get out. And sometimes there are riddles to answer. Sometimes you just have to be sort of physically strong and muscled through it. And this is at 6:30 and 8 p.m. Mountain Time. And then on Sunday, it's at 1:30 and 3 o'clock. Tickets are $20 per person or $150 if you want to get together a team of no more than eight people and try to get out of an escape room to benefit the Boys and Girls Club of Richland County. And this is at the former Sunrise Equipment Building in Sydney, Montana.
Duo 1717 will be at the Christensen Recital Hall, Vidston's Hall of Music on Concordia College's campus in Moorhead. It's Tuesday that takes place. A classical crossover duo, baritone Jean-Bernard Sirian and pianist Veena K. Kulkarni, fuse art, folk, world, and religious idioms to celebrate individual communities while also creating spaces for intercultural dialogue. They'll be performing their Crick Crack Stories of Africa and the New World program, Haitian folk songs and storytelling meet Cuban and Brazilian art, and this is music seasoned with the words of Langston Hughes. Quite a mashup there. At a side of American Negro spirituals and art song, and you have a feast of words and music. This is again Tuesday at 7:30 at the Vidston Hall of Music at Concordia. It's $20 for adult general admission, $10 for students under 18.
Parenting is hard, and so sometimes you need a parent's night out. So this Friday in Jamestown, the Two Rivers Activity Center is trying to help you out. So from 5:30 to 9 o'clock, you could drop your kids off at the Activity Center, and they get to play games, possibly go swimming, and get some of those wiggles out, and you get to go and do whatever it is you want to do. 5:30 to 9 o'clock, $20 for the first kid and $15 for additional kids Friday night in Jamestown.
Ethiopia Reed's Style and Garden Show. That's Sunday in Grand Forks at the All Seasons Garden Center. Ethiopia Reed's Style and Garden Show is presented by Gap and Old Navy. It starts at 3:30 and again at 4:15. This is the All Seasons Garden Center in Grand Forks. There will be projects to do for children from ArtWise and Dakota Science Center, raffles and drawings, including a 2018 American Girl doll titled Luciana, doll clothes, books, and gift certificates. All Seasons Garden Center will be decorated for Christmas, so ice cream floats will be served, and it's free. All proceeds from the raffles, drawings, and donations will benefit Ethiopia Reads literacy programs. Again, 3 to 5 in Grand Forks at the All Seasons Garden Center, the Ethiopia Reads Style and Garden Show.
All right, my pick of the week is this Saturday, the 10th. It is International Science Center and Science Museum Day, and you can celebrate this in Bismarck at the Gateway to Science. This is a yearly global event that talks about the importance, the impact, the reach, the kind of educational opportunities that are available at science museums. So go hang out at the Gateway to Science 10 to 5 in Bismarck, and it's free.
The North Dakota Human Rights Film and Arts Festival gets going tonight in Grand Forks at the Empire Arts Center. Actually started this afternoon, but there's another showing at 6 o'clock. The festival features the works of filmmakers from all around the world, including a couple we've talked about here on Main Street, Dodging Bullets, a documentary about historical trauma and Native Americans, and Home, a documentary about homelessness in North Dakota. The cost is $15 at the door, only $2 for students and seniors. That price is right. Thank you to Seth Habhegger for helping us every week with what's happening.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of 750 Touchstone Cooperative consumer-owned utilities dedicated to innovation, integrity, and commitment to community.
If you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question, it's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via Facebook, where we are Main Street at Prairie Public. And you can still call toll-free 888-755-6377.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 8th. The political borders involving this north-central region fluctuated for decades. In 1849, when Minnesota Territory was created, it stretched all the way to the Missouri River. When Minnesota became a state, 9 years later, the western remainder of the territory went unorganized. On this date, in 1859, two meetings convened in Vermilion and Yankton in what is now South Dakota. The meetings agreed on a statement, called a memorial, to petition for the creation of a new territory. More than 420 people signed the Yankton Memorial, which was presented to Congress about a month later. A Minnesota senator introduced a bill to create the new territory, but the topic was tabled after questions about slavery came up. About a year after that first convention, another meeting took place at Yankton, urging organization of the leftover territory. John Blair Smith Todd, an Army veteran who would eventually become Dakota Territory's first delegate to Congress, was a major advocate. Another memorial went to Congress with more than 470 signatures. This time, the effort picked up steam, and the Senate Committee on Territories rolled out a bill creating the territories of Dakota and Nevada. President Buchanan made Dakota Territory official in March of 1861. Word reached Yankton a week and a half later. Now, the residents of Dakota Territory had to create their government, everything from counties to a criminal code. It was quite a task. The original territory was huge, including modern-day Wyoming and much of Montana. In 1886, the border changed again as the territory was reduced to the present state boundaries of North and South Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I heard something go off, obviously the gunshots, and I realized that it was not music very, very quickly, and I heard everyone scream, "Get down."
The gunman in the shooting at a California nightclub was a Marine Corps veteran. Investigators have identified the weapon and are now searching for a motive. The latest from Ventura County on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Friday on Main Street, we'll talk about war crimes with Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. This coming Sunday is Veterans Day and marks the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. And history professor Tom Easer will share some thoughts about that. Dave Thompson will join us for our weekly discussion of the week's headlines, and Madeline will review another new movie, another new musical, Bohemian Rhapsody. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.